Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking at who redeem most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Three guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Mike Lofgren, who retired in disgust after a near 30-year career as a Republican staffer in Congress. He's in despair over what his former party has become, and he'll give us the details. And then towards the bottom of the hour, we'll look at 9/11 conspiracy theories as the 10th anniversary of that event gives them new life. Two guests, the journalist Jonathan Kay and the historian Kathy Olmsted, will analyze the appeal of such theories. Before that, just a few words on Obama's job scheme. The first phrase that comes to mind is better than nothing. Extending a 2-point cut in the employee Social Security tax will help cash-strapped households and offer a decent economic kick. So too will modest infrastructure investment schemes. But tax breaks for employers that are part of the plan don't really inspire much hiring. Bosses hire when they think that there's demand for their goods and their services, and tax breaks are just gravy. Since there's not much demand on the horizon, there's not likely to be much hiring either. Extending unemployment benefits is an urgent necessity, and allowing them to be used to top up pay when workers go on short hours is an experiment worth trying. But the overall effect, were the package to become law, would not be profound, and would be rather short-lived. Mark Zandi of Economy.com, who was a McCain advisor in 2008 and so can't be counted as an Obama apologist, estimates that it would boost job growth next year by about 2 million, which is not nothing, though we've only recovered about 1 million of the 8 million jobs lost during the recession, so there's still a long way to go. But it's hard to see Congress passing much of this, given the GOP's strategy of saying no to everything the president proposes, no matter how many conciliatory gestures he makes in their direction. Back after a musical break to hear about the evolution or devolution of the GOP. A son of Work Song by Rhythm King and Her Friends, a group of lesbian leftists from Berlin. They have a remix series called She Considers Capitalism Not to Be Eternal, which is a nice title, and I wish I had one of those songs, but I don't. My first guest is Mike Lofgren. Lofgren spent nearly 30 years as a Republican congressional staffer, specializing in budget and economic issues. A little while ago, he decided he couldn't take what's happened to his party anymore. His indictment, at over 6,000 words, it's epic by the standards of the web, appeared on September 3rd on the Truthout website. Mike Lofgren. Now, what's responsible for this rightward move? Is there some sort of base, a popular base, electoral base, or a corporate contributor base that's really pushed it? Or ideology, think tanks? What really has been driving this rightward move for the last three decades?
I would say all of the above. Both parties, I will hasten to add. I'm not a Democrat. I'm an independent. Both parties are beholden to corporate money. The Republicans a little more enthusiastically because that's more consonant with the ideology of business Republicans, whereas the Democrats try to be this party of the New Deal and the common man and the working stiff, but they're torn in both directions. They have to take corporate money, and this accounts for their wishy-washiness and ambivalence. Whereas the Republicans, of course, have that corporate contributor base that they're very attentive to. And then there's the more grassroots, it's certainly more numerous, the religious right base, and that accounts for all the culture wars. And that certainly pulls the ideology rightward. And then, of course, you have a very effective network of think tanks that really since the early 80s, has been operating in Washington and is kind of a pipeline for legislative ideas and a legislative agenda.
And how's the Tea Party fit into this? Is this really a genuine popular mobilization, or are they being manipulated by think tanks and corporate money? And how influential have they been in Republican strategy over the last couple of years?
I would blame the mainstream media to a great degree. They don't really tell us who the Tea Party really is. We don't have a demographic. How big is it? We know how many people belong to unions in the United States. How many people are really Tea Party self-identified voters? We don't know that. We also don't know, are they just a subset or wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican Party, that when the Bush political brand was obviously toxic there when he left office, did people simply repackage sort of old wine in new bottles and say that, oh, this is an independent movement? Well, it could be, but we don't know. Is it a grassroots movement, or is it essentially an AstroTurf movement funded by the Koch brothers or Freedom Works? I can't really say. It's up to some investigative journalism to find out.
Well, the journalists have certainly spent a lot of time reporting on the Tea Party, but they're not asking those sorts of questions, are they?
They're almost reporting too much in a superficial sense of saying, oh, the Tea Party wants this and they want that, and we're going to have to listen to the Tea Party. In that sense, they report a lot, but they don't really find out who's pulling the strings, if any strings are being pulled.
During the recent debt ceiling melodrama, which was just remarkably insane. I mean, I sat watching this thing with my jaw dropping constantly. But the Republicans are presumably a business party. You would assume that the business class has absolutely no interest in selling the reputation of U.S. Treasury bonds, yet they were willing to do that and even threatened default, although Eric Cantor, of course, was short Treasury bonds. But leaving that aside, what do we make of this? Are they playing chicken? Is this purely partisan gamesmanship? What was that all about?
I suppose the freshmen who were really driving this in a lot of respects, I don't think Boehner was too eager to do that, but he was also eager not to jeopardize his speakership, which he would do if he dissed the freshmen. I think that the Tea Party-induced freshmen really didn't care. When you have somebody like Michelle Bachmann, who, after all, has a vote in the House of Representatives, said she didn't really believe in, you know, that there was going to be any default and that it wasn't such a big deal, I take them at their word. If Wall Street keeps giving to the Republicans, well, I don't know what to make of it.
Why does Wall Street keep giving to the Republicans? What do they want from them?
They don't want to pay any taxes. If you look at the plans of Romney, Herman Cain, and now Huntsman, they all want to cut taxes. And I think if you actually look at the plans, they would cut them by substantial amounts. Now, what does that do? It exacerbates the deficit they say they hate like poison.
Why do they say they hate the deficit so much? I mean, they're certainly willing to cut taxes and wage a couple of foreign wars simultaneously. When they're doing that, they don't seem to worry about the deficit. So why is it suddenly a concern?
I think it's a concern as long as Obama is president, or as long as any Democrat is president. It's a pressing concern. You notice these people, and this was what always frustrated me. There was utter silence from the Republican Party during the 8 years of Bush about the deficit. And the two signature policies that most contributed to our current situation are the war and the associated defense and other spending associated with the war, and the tax cuts. The tax cuts were nearly $3 trillion. People tend to count the war only as, well, it was $1.3 trillion according to Congressional Budget Office. Well, you got to add the debt service. Then it's up to 1.7. Then you add the $1 trillion in Pentagon spending we spent justifying it because we were at war. This is non-war spending above the inflation rate over those 8 years. That comes to another trillion. Add debt service, that's 1.3. You got $3 trillion right there. You add all the extra State Department spending, Homeland Security, and all that, and associated economic costs, and you're up to about $4 trillion. Now, 3 and 4 is $7 trillion. That is half the debt we have accumulated since 1789 from two Bush policies.
Let's talk about Obama and the Republicans. They hate him with a passion, and yet he is constantly trying to make friends with them and compromise with them. Why the hatred and why his repeated lust for compromise and unwillingness, it seems, to understand what the party is all about?
You saw what happened, particularly during the impeachment business in 1998-99, what Republicans thought of Clinton. So I'm not certain they wouldn't have a lot of vitriol against any Democrat who was elected president. With Obama, they're just almost invidious to state one's suspicions. But when you see, and it was one of the final straws for me, when you see that birther nonsense, that this guy is not a real American. I mean, people said called Clinton everything under the sun, but they didn't doubt he was a U.S., legitimate U.S. citizen. With Obama, there is that thing of being the other. And I'm sure that elected officials don't believe that themselves, but they indulged it among people far too much.
I was speaking with Mike Lofgren, a longtime Republican staffer who wrote about his resignation in a recent piece in Truthout. John Oliver on The Daily Show last night said that he described the Republican Party as essentially pandering to a base of elderly lunatics.
Well, I'm not going to go that far. What I will say is the GOP was very successful in the 2010 election at getting senior citizen demographics to break rather decisively in favor of voting for them. Totally counterintuitive in the sense that one of their things is we got to rein in entitlements, and that term isn't further specified, but the two biggest are Social Security and Medicare, and these people are dependent on those.
It seems to me that one of the reasons Republicans won, perhaps the principal reason, was that they were simply the other guys and the economy was a wreck. Now, the Republican leadership seems to have concluded from the election that there's actual support for an agenda of cutting deeply into Social Security and Medicare. Do they believe that? Are they really convinced that there's broad support for their ideological agenda?
That's hard to say whether it is or not, or whether it's kind of the bubble effect of a group of people get together and they all sort of have the same ideas and they convince themselves that these ideas are good and they're getting support from their sort of allied groups of think tanks and academies and so forth. I mean, Cato Institute and the Heritage Foundation have been trying to undermine Social Security since the early 80s, and one of the sort of landmark pieces on that, it was by someone from Cato Institute who said, we know it's popular now, but we will undercut support for it with a Leninist strategy. That doesn't sound particularly small-d democratic to me.
You write in the piece that the Republicans have a deep love for militarism. Could you talk about that some?
Well, I think I could rest my case simply by saying that at least half of the signature policies that created this debt and deficit are the war. And it was a totally unnecessary war that had nothing to do with capturing or killing Osama bin Laden, but they went ahead with it anyway. We've seen a number of Republican figures agitating about Iran, getting involved in Syria. We saw that stuff that happened in 2008 in the border war between Russia and Georgia. They really seem to love it, and it's bankrupting the country. I saw a piece in the Washington Post, an article in their Sunday edition, that gave a sort of matter-of-fact and very uncritical look at the fact that the military is pretty much preparing for perpetual war, war forever.
You say that the Republican leadership is also a very, they think that by discrediting government they will gain, so that no matter how low Congress's approval rating will go, and I think it's what now around 16% or something like that, they will be the beneficiaries of that. How does that work? They actually think that they can gain by discrediting government?
It's actually lower than that, according to the latest NBC Washington Post poll. It's 13%. With 86% disapproving, and I don't know where that 1% went. It's undecided. Evidently, their strategy has worked, and as they are the programmatic anti-government party that perpetually runs against Washington, no matter how long these guys have been in Washington, I might add, they are logically the gainers.
And what do you make of the current field of Republican presidential candidates?
Not much. All I have to do is listen to when one says something that's intermittently moderate, such as Mitt Romney talking about the real possibility of climate change and then having to quickly repent of that, or people who may or may not even believe it, suddenly having doubts about the theory of evolution.
This kind of agenda we're talking about, the capital gains tax cuts, the extreme Tea Party positions, all that business, the religious fundamentalism, represents a minority of the electorate, 20-30%, 40% at the outside. Yet they think they can win elections on that. Is the public just not paying attention? Does the public not understand what this party is all about? Or how can they win elections on such an extreme agenda?
It is definitely possible. It has happened in other countries in other periods of time. And a very energized minority can always trump an apathetic or confused majority. And I think that's what we're seeing happen here.
Whatever you say about them, they do seem to have a set of fervent beliefs, whereas the Democrats, as you described earlier, are divided. They have to pretend sometimes to be kind of a New Dealer social democratic party, yet they really are fundamentally a corporate party. So the fact that the Republicans actually have a set of principles and beliefs give them an advantage?
Oh, it definitely does. The thing is, sort of when you lose, you tend to think your beliefs cannot have been responsible for you having lost. So you just double down and keep doing it. And there's a kind of bandwagon effect among true believers that they really want to go out and work. Whereas a party that would be ambivalent and torn between its donors and its alleged constituency is going to have the disadvantage.
Do the Republicans really embrace the Grover Norquist, shrink it till you can drown it in a bathtub approach? Is that really the fiscal strategy, or are they just trying to get through the night? Is there a long-term strategy behind what they do, or is it just pure expediency from day to day?
In a way, it's a little of both, in that, in general, that is their plan. They were willing to hold the FAA hostage, and quite frankly, our airline system, our whole civil aviation system, has been built and subsidized by the government since its inception with flying the airmail in the 1920s, and has remained so ever since. Yet they don't seem really concerned about it. Probably the only saving grace in that respect is they tend to be very interested in projects in their district for the most part. I think that was shown quite graphically earlier in the year when Speaker Boehner attempted to save the alternative engine project for the F-35 that was built in southwestern Ohio.
So it seems like the future of the United States is almost hostage to a rather lunatic death cult.
Well, that might be putting it a little pointedly, but our tradition in a representative democracy with a two-party system pretty well cemented in by tradition and inertia, is that there's two distinct parties, but they have to have some conciliation, some notion of compromise, some notion that politics stops at the water's edge. For instance, this was very upsetting to foreign investors to see this sort of thing happening, because no other country in the world except Denmark requires a vote on the debt extension. But they were willing to damage America's international standing for the sake of a domestic dispute. And that's just not healthy.
That was Mike Lofgren, a longtime Republican staffer in Congress who resigned out of disgust with his party. You could find a long explanation of that decision on the Truth Out website. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web, kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was my conspiracy segment musical staple, Insignificance by the Mekons. With the 10th anniversary of 9/11 upon us, conspiracy theories around that event are experiencing a fresh salience, much to my distress. I think they reduce the sloppy process of ruling class power over state and society to the machinations of shadowy potentates who all agree with each other and exercise perfect control, though you do have to wonder how, if the plotters are so damn clever, researchers always manage to unlock the mysteries so easy and disseminate them without consequence. My first guest is Jonathan Kay. Kay is an editor of the National Post, the Toronto newspaper, and author of Among the Truthers, published in May by HarperCollins. Jonathan Kay. Welcome, Jonathan Kay. Tell us about your journey into the world of the Truthers. Who did you visit and how long did you spend there?
It started in 2008 when it briefly became an issue in Canadian politics, of all places. And I wrote briefly about it for the website of my newspaper here in Toronto. And I was just amazed by the storm of conspiracy theory emails I got, just hundreds. And I realized I'd tapped into this vast subculture of 9/11 conspiracy theorists.
Now, were those from Americans or Canadians?
Half and half. What's interesting is Canadians, like people around the world, have really co-opted American conspiracy theories. If you talk to conspiracy theories in Europe or Canada or Russia, often the conspiracy theories they embrace really center on Washington and Wall Street.
What's the Canadian angle? Why are Canadians interested in this?
Well, there's a strong streak of anti-Americanism in Canada. We're always anxious about what the United States is going to do. We're fearful. We're jealous. Although maybe the last year or two, not so much on the economic front. And out of that anxiety comes sometimes irrational fears about evil plots that are being hatched by American presidents.
What always mystifies me about this sort of thing is there are plenty of rational things to dislike about the United States. If you're on the political left, you certainly don't like American violence abroad and many other things you can actually, there's an actual historical record for. Why go to the lengths of inventing these tall tales?
Well, a lot of times it's extrapolation from legitimate distrust. And 9/11 isn't a great example of this, because in 2003 and 2004, you had a lot of people, especially on the left, who were appalled that there were no weapons of mass destruction found in Iraq. And they felt they'd been lied to. And the question they asked themselves is, well, if they lied about this, what else are they lying about? And often it is in answering that question that conspiracy theorists start their wild extrapolations. They start to believe all kinds of fantasies. And smart people often will stop themselves from that conjecture. You know, Noam Chomsky is a great example. He's a guy who has nothing but contempt for 9/11 conspiracy theorists because he says there's plenty of other legitimate social activism to be done and political activism to be done. We don't have to start inventing Hollywood fantasies. But many people don't have that intellectual self-awareness, that ability to draw the line between legitimate distrust and legitimate activism and legitimate questions about the government and full-blown conspiracy theories.
Actually, if you want to get conspiratorial, Noam pointed me once to a report by a Pentagon consultant suggesting that the Pentagon promote or embrace these sorts of conspiracy theories because they distract people from real events.
Well, they also diffuse activist energies. I was privy to a bunch of correspondence between Chomsky and some 9/11 conspiracy theorists. And Chomsky was quite appalled by their presumptuousness. He said, I've been doing this for decades, and I've been fighting American involvement in Latin America and the Middle East and Africa and all this stuff. And you guys come along, and without any background in activism, you proclaim yourself to be grand prophets of all that is evil in American foreign policy. And he was quite dumbstruck by how presumptuous they were.
So how did you accomplish your research? How did you enter this world?
Well, I did it in the traditional way, face-to-face interviews and attending conferences and that sort of thing. But it was actually quite easy in the sense that 9/11 conspiracy theories, like all modern conspiracy movements, is 99% done on the Internet. Most of the research for this book you could do from anywhere with an Internet-connected computer. And that's because the last 20 years have witnessed a really stunning transformation of conspiracy subcultures. For generations, the biggest problem of a conspiracy theorist was getting his message out because the mainstream media wouldn't publish his stuff. People like you and me were the gatekeepers. And then all of a sudden in the mid-90s, that big problem he had of getting his message out was completely eliminated overnight. He could just publish blogs or websites, send out email, and communicate with millions of people around the Internet for free. And so the conspiracist universe has completely taken on a virtual dimension. And that's what you've seen with 9/11 conspiracy theories. It's all based on websites and, most importantly, on web-circulated videos like Loose Change, which people can download and watch on YouTube and Google Video and such.
I guess my former radio station raised a lot of money off Loose Change, I'm embarrassed to say. What is the specific appeal of these 9/11 stories? I mean, you look at the mainstream story, or if you just read broadly, you can see that Al-Qaeda had... not my kind of organization, but they had a critique of U.S. foreign policy. They had some definite goals. You could situate it within a structure of political analysis. What is the appeal, then, of leaping to these fantastic stories of how the buildings came down?
Well, conspiracy theories are like religion in the sense that they're theories of evil. They explain the cosmic question of why bad things happen to good people. Why evil exists in the universe. This is something that religion used to provide us, but for a lot of people, we live in a post-religious age, and they don't have religion, so they embrace conspiracy theories, which supply them with devil figures. And your question is, well, we already have a devil figure in Osama bin Laden. Why do they have to pick Dick Cheney instead of Osama bin Laden? And the reason is that it's not emotionally satisfying to imagine that that this was done to America from a cave 10,000 miles away. The advantage of telling yourself that your own government did this is that your own government is politically accountable. You know, you could bring down your own government. You could go arrest Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and George Bush. Whereas when the threat comes from these mysterious places overseas, it's not as emotionally satisfying because it's more unreal. And the same, by the way, is true of medical conspiracy theories. You know, if your child, God forbid, gets a disease, it's not very satisfying to say, well, this is, you know, this happens, it's just a genetic fluke, and it's a horrible thing. It's, in a way, it's more comforting to think that there's some politically accountable pharmaceutical executive who did it to your child, because then you could spend your life campaigning against them and bring them down and bring them to court. It supplies a villain against whom you could vent your energy.
Now, of course, there are real-world conspiracies. You know, there's the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, the Gulf of Tonkin was a conspiracy, you know, any number of things you can point to that are real conspiracies. But what is different about these sorts of stories that that attract cults?
Real-life conspiracies do exist, and I'm careful to mention that in my book. They tend to be fairly small, fairly grubby, fairly easily discovered, because human beings are really bad at keeping secrets. You know, so if you look at something like Watergate, it's sort of a typical conspiracy. We had a few people involved. They screwed it up. Their objectives were fairly narrow-minded and parochial, and we found out the details. The difference with most conspiracy theories is they're on, you know, many orders of magnitude more ambitious. They tend to involve hundreds or thousands or even millions of people collaborating internationally in secret to, you know, to take over the entire world, to bring down skyscrapers, to start wars and depressions and that sort of thing. They tend to be the stuff out of Hollywood movies. You know, 9/11 conspiracy theories are a good example. In order to pull off something like the 9/11 conspiracy as an inside job, you would need thousands of demolitions experts and spies, and you'd have to infiltrate the media and the judiciary and NORAD, and it would require the participation of legions of people, and of course all of them would have to keep silent for a decade. None of the insiders would have to tell their story. And of course, this isn't how human nature works. If this had actually happened in real life, within days of it, we'd have dozens of people coming forward spilling the beans, because, you know, that's human nature. We're bad at keeping secrets, and that's why the media keeps getting leaks from government.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Kay, who is an editor at the National Post, the Toronto newspaper, and also author of Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground. Whether you like the Bush administration or not, I don't think that competence would be something that people would put at the top of the list of their virtues. How do people deal with that?
They deal with it with the mythology of hypercompetence. And this is a word that Popular Mechanics editor James Meigs made up to describe the way conspiracy theorists think. On one hand, conspiracy theorists think that government is incredibly evil, you know, like Darth Vader, you know, plotting to destroy or conquer the world. On the other hand, they have this awe of the government as being hyper-competent, able to track any plane in the sky in a matter of seconds, you know, to read all our cell phone conversations and email in the blink of an eye, to detect any plot anywhere around the world instantly. This almost childlike awe of government powers, which is why if you go to a conspiracy theorist convention, it's almost like a Buck Rogers convention where they're always talking about sort of space rays and all kinds of science fiction weaponry that they imagine the government used on 9/11. In that way, it's very adolescent, which is why conspiracy theories are primarily a male world.
Yeah. How would you characterize the demographics of the adherents?
Mostly, age-wise, it's mostly two groups of people. It's college students who tend to be susceptible to any kind of radical movement that allows them to adopt countercultural poses. And you also have middle-aged men who, a lot of these people are former computer technicians or engineers or academics, you know, smart people who like puzzle solving and spend a lot of time on the internet. And it's almost all men. If you go to these conventions, you will see some women, but they tend to be the girlfriends or wives who've been dragged there, and usually they're quite bored.
And anything about their politics? Are they far left, far right, incomprehensible stew?
You will tend to, tends to be the extreme fringes. So you'll find hard left conspiracy theorists and hard right conspiracy theorists. In fact, one thing that I found interesting was that the hard left and hard right conspiracy theorists essentially have the same narrative of 9/11. They both think that this evil cabal of Washington insiders did 9/11 in order to take over the world. The only difference is that the left-wing conspiracy theorists think that it was done as part of a plan to create an all-powerful corporate oligarchy headed by Dick Cheney and Halliburton. Whereas the right-wing conspiracy theorists, they agree with everything except they think it was part of a plot to deliver the world to a one world left-wing communist government led by Al Gore and the United Nations. But in every other aspect, the conspiracy theories are the same.
So they've had no problem handling the transition of power from Bush to Obama?
They've had a little bit of problems. Like if you talk to someone like Alex Jones, who's a prominent conspiracy theorist based in Texas, and he has radio shows. When I interviewed him, he said, oh, Obama, Bush, it makes no difference. You know, the Democrats and the Republicans both answer to the same corporate paymasters. the Bilderbergers or the New World Order or whatever he imagines it to be. And there are some hardcore conspiracy theorists who are like that. In truth, the 9/11 conspiracy movements did suffer a decline after Obama took office. And the reason is that conspiracy theories, like Hollywood movies, need a good villain. And Dick Cheney supplied a great villain figure. He even looks the part. But then when Obama came into office, it was less romantic and less interesting to use him as a villain figure and to argue that he was covering for the crimes of the Bush administration. So people drifted away into other conspiracist movements. In the last couple of years, for instance, financial conspiracy theories have become more popular because of the recession.
What sort of theories are you talking about?
The Federal Reserve figures extremely prominently in modern conspiracy theories. And also, of course, you have the birther conspiracy theories. Although the birther conspiracy theories are different from truther conspiracy theories because, as I said, the 9/11 truth conspiracy theories you could find on the hard left and the hard right, whereas the Barack Obama birther conspiracy theories you only find on the right side of the political spectrum. There's no such thing as a left-wing birther that I've found.
The Federal Reserve stuff and even to some degree the 9/11 stuff, a lot of these conspiracy theories often have Jews, one way or the other, playing a prominent role. What's that? What was the root of that?
Yes. In my book, I say that not all conspiracy theorists are anti-Semites, not by a long shot, but all conspiracy theory movements do attract anti-Semites. And that is because the basic narrative of conspiracy theories, which is that a small, evil, secret group is seeking to control the world and dominate the world economy and start wars and depressions for their own profit, that basic narrative is exactly the narrative that anti-Semites have been spreading for centuries. So the two narratives are very, very similar, which is why anti-Semites are always attracted to conspiracy movements. And I should add that sometimes the anti-Semites pop up in very strange ways. For instance, in UFO conspiracy circles, you get some anti-Semites who argue that the extraterrestrial soap opera is controlled by a small gnome-like group of extraterrestrials with big noses who are greedy. And as they describe their fantasies, you see that they're basically projecting their anti-Semitic fantasies on outer space. And you get this a lot in the 9/11 movement, too, where there's a huge focus on the Mossad and Israel and Jews, although they tend to use coded language. Instead of using the term Jews, they will say dual Israeli-American citizen is their euphemism. And you know, they'll focus on how this person is a Jew or that person is a Jew. But I should emphasize that not all 9/11 conspiracy theorists are anti-Semites.
Richard Hofstadter, in his book, In the Paranoid Style, wrote about conspiracy theorists when they were pretty much a phenomenon of the far right in the United States, that their books are always festooned with footnotes. There's always lots and lots of detail and supporting evidence, even though the overall story itself is insane. Did you find that sort of thing?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at Alex Jones or Michael Rupert, who's a prominent 9/11 conspiracy theorist, you'll find hundreds of pages of footnotes. Usually there's a little grain of truth to every assertion they make. It's this huge fantasy fabric, this tapestry, but every little square in it does have some little footnote attached to it. And many of these people are like amateur librarians. You know, if you interview them in their houses, you will find, you know, just boxes and boxes and boxes of material, and they become obsessed with it, and they will just keep spitting factoids at you. It's one of the reasons why debating a conspiracy theorist is always, you never win, because whatever your argument is, they will always have some memorized stockpile of talking points and factoids that they will throw at you until eventually they throw a factoid at you that you just say, you know, I've never heard that one. I have to go on the internet and look it up. Of course, by that time it's too late, and they declare victory in your argument.
It's funny, in their world there are no loose ends, no coincidences, no mistakes. It's all very neatly tied up.
And the weird thing is, on the right side of the political spectrum, is that you get these hardcore libertarians who say government can't do anything right. All the money we send to Washington is wasted. These people are inept and they're morons. And yet they'll turn around and say, except when it comes to blowing up the World Trade Center. In that case, they were flawless technicians. And so there is a kind of doublethink that goes on in their logic.
Oh, and the same with the left and Bush, I guess, in some ways.
Conspiracy theorists tend to flourish among those who feel disenfranchised. And so right now, it's the right-wingers with the birther stuff. But as you say, the left-wingers during the Bush years, I mean, conspiracy theories flourished on the left because they felt disenfranchised when Bush was in office. And, you know, if the Republicans win the 2012 election, I fully expect that conspiracy theories will once again switch to the domain of the left.
That was Jonathan Kay, author of Among the Truthers, published in May by HarperCollins. My next guest is Kathy Olmsted, a professor of history at the University of California, Davis, and author of Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories in American Democracy, World War I to 9/11, published a few years ago by Oxford University Press. Kathy Olmsted. Welcome, Kathy Olmsted. As the September 11th anniversary approaches, I'm curious how all the nest of conspiracy theories that have grown up around that event compare with earlier episodes of conspiracy theories. Is it run-of-the-mill? Is it the mother of all? How's it stack up?
Well, in terms of the number of people who believe it, it's not nearly as widespread, at least yet, as the JFK conspiracy theories. At their peak, about 90% of Americans believed that there was a conspiracy to assassinate John Kennedy. And now I believe it's about 70%. Whereas with 9/11 conspiracy theories, the last poll showed about a third of Americans believe there was a conspiracy, with 9/11 involving the U.S. government.
Now, that might range from just suppressing knowledge or looking the other way to active planning. How do the numbers break down?
Well, I think it's about half and half of the people who believe conspiracy theories, about half believe that there was a controlled demolition of the towers, so the event was actually planned and executed by the U.S. government, and the other half believe that the Bush administration knew that the attacks were coming and just did nothing to prevent them.
What do you read as the motives behind these? Why, the second one first, why would a government be so indifferent to death and destruction on its own soil, and even more extreme, why would it plot such? What's your understanding of why people believe these things?
Well, they believe that the Bush administration wanted to have an excuse to go to war in Iraq, a way to get the people riled up so that they would support an invasion of Iraq. And so they either knew this was coming and thought, oh, how convenient, or they actually did it themselves. This is what the conspiracy theorists believe.
What can you say about the demographics and politics of the adherents?
Well, like most conspiracy theories, the adherents tend to come from the extremes, the extreme left and the extreme right. Obviously, I think with 9/11 theories, there's more of a leftist slant to them. There's a lot of political science work that shows that when Democrats are presidents, then conspiracy theories about the right increase, and when about the left. And when Republicans are president, then there are more conspiracies by the left about the right. And I think that was the case with 9/11 theories.
And so thus we see the truther thing around a Democratic president. The birther thing around the Democratic president.
So that there's more energy right now, I think, in the conspiracy theories about Obama, because he's the one with power. And the 9/11 theories, which were so prevalent in certain quarters of the left during the Bush administration, I think some of the energy has gone out once Bush left office, because it becomes more of historical interest, because the conspirators are gone.
The historical record is quite open and available on so many episodes of duplicity and violence on the part of the U.S. government. Why do we need to invent all these elaborate scenarios when there's plenty of real material to work with?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I think that's one of the main problems with 9/11 theories is that people focus on them. They focus on the physical details of the 9/11 attacks and what they see as inconsistencies or lies. And as a result, they're not really focusing on much bigger and more important and more realistic conspiracy theories or conspiracies, actual conspiracies by the Bush administration.
Such as?
Well, one of the reasons that I think why 9/11 theories became so widespread was that the Bush administration deliberately misrepresented, lied about the reasons for going to war in Iraq. And so that's, I think, what people should be talking about, not about the 9/11 theories.
But we know quite a bit about that. We even knew at the time that some concoction was underway, but now we know in retrospect, we have plenty of evidence of that. Have these revelations at all made it more difficult to believe the extravagant 9/11 stories, or aren't they just irrelevant?
Well, I think what happened is when people learned the extent of the deception involved in the Iraq War, then they began to say, well, if they lied so much about that, then they must have lied about 9/11 too. That's the connection.
Now, conspiracy theories have a long history in the United States, going back into the 19th century. Are we unusual in this, or is this a commonplace around the world?
Well, there are conspiracy theories in all cultures and in every era. There tend to be more conspiracy theories in polarized societies. So people who feel left out or very different from the people in power begin to develop conspiracy theories. So more diverse societies, societies that are more mobile, and both of those things apply to the United States, obviously, tend to have more conspiracy theories.
Now, in the 19th century, I believe you write that many of our conspiracy theories were about foreign plotters, right?
Well, yes. In U.S. history, I mean, there have been conspiracy theories since the Puritans, but they tended to be about people who were not white and Christian. So there were conspiracy theories about white and Protestant. So there were conspiracy theories about Indians, about African Americans, about Jews, about Catholics and Mormons throughout American history. But what begins to happen in the 20th century is as the U.S. government begins to get a lot more power and a lot more secret power, then you get more conspiracy theories about the U.S. government itself.
Now, the Kennedy assassination seems in some ways like the first of these modern conspiracy theories. Is that kind of the departure from that old style of 19th century theorizing?
Well, I think really the dividing line is World War I, because that's the point at which the U.S. government really gets enough power to be truly frightening to people. And it's the time when the U.S. government criminalizes dissent with the Espionage and Sedition Acts and has the Bureau of Investigation begin surveilling people who oppose the war. So it's really in World War I that you start getting what we would recognize as modern anti-government conspiracy theories. And it's not just people within the government, but the government itself that is conspiring against the people. And then every war from then on has conspiracy theories, with people who oppose the war believing that there was a plot by the government to trick the people into going to war.
Which, in many cases, was not entirely untrue.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing about these conspiracy theories that are widespread. I mean, I could have written books and books and books about conspiracy theories about the U.S. government, but I was selective in looking at theories that have, you know, at least a third of the public believing them. So in other words, ones that are plausible. And the reason that they're plausible is that, you know, there's actual evidence of the U.S. government conspiring in those cases.
Yeah, well, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was based on a deception, wasn't it?
Yes, of course. And the investigation into Kennedy's assassination deliberately did not look at many conspiracies the U.S. government was involved in, because the Johnson administration did not want it to come out that, for example, Kennedy was trying to kill Castro, and Johnson was very concerned that Castro might have actually been involved in the assassination himself, and that might lead to World War III. So there were real conspiracies involved in the Kennedy assassination, and there was a real attempt to cover up those conspiracies, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the U.S. government itself conspired to kill the president.
What do you make of the durability of this? We're approaching 50 years ago that this happened. Why do people still obsess over the Zapruder film and the second gunman and all these things? Why is this still such a live theory?
Well, I think the Kennedy assassination in particular has so many possibilities of different paths you can follow if you're interested in looking for a conspiracy theory, that it becomes like a detective game, because there's the Castro plots, there's Castro himself, there's Oswald being a communist and being involved in the anti-Castro activities, though, you know, there's the mafia, there's so many people that you could look at. And so, and also the fact that there really was a conspiracy to kill Castro and a conspiracy to cover that up and make sure the links to the Kennedy assassination were not revealed. And so there's a lot of interesting questions, and I think people realize that, and so they get fascinated by the event and wanting to prove it, you know, prove what happened themselves.
And from listening to you, I'm guessing that you might not think that the Warren Commission report is the last word on this one.
Well, no, I don't think the Warren Commission report is the last word at all. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, that Oswald did not act alone. It's just the Warren Commission really didn't want to know if he acted alone. There were too many alarming possibilities. If you really, really looked into what the secret policies of the Kennedy administration were.
I'm speaking with Kathy Olmsted, who's a professor of history at University of California, Davis, and author of the book Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories and American Democracy, World War I to 9/11. Now, getting back to 9/11, there are real conspiracies in history, many of them, and we know quite a bit of detail about them. Why don't people focus so much on that, and why are they far more likely to create websites about the melting point of steel? I mean, why the obsessive interest on something that is perhaps not even all that relevant when there's plenty of real analysis that can be done?
I really don't know the answer to that. It is, I think, perplexing, because there are some really interesting unanswered questions about 9/11. Senator Bob Graham with the Intelligence Committee had an investigation that was just getting started when the control of Congress switched hands, so he couldn't continue. But he was looking into some really intriguing links between the hijackers and foreign governments. Now, how much did the Pakistani secret police know? How much did the Saudi secret police know? I mean, there are some things about 9/11 that we really don't know yet. But the 9/11 theorists in general do not focus on that. They're more interested in the melting point of steel.
They're not shy of work. I mean, they do an awful lot of research. They compile enormous files with lots of footnotes. It can't be a matter of laziness, exactly. Is there some kind of psychopolitical explanation for these kinds of obsessions?
Well, there's been a lot of sociology and psychology that's been done on conspiracy theorists. So psychologists say that it's a certain personality type that is most threatened by random events. Sociologists say that it is people who tend to feel like they're not being represented in the government, who have anti-government conspiracy theories. In general, though, the conspiracy theorists themselves really hate that kind of research because they believe they're being put on the couch and, pathologized and told that they have a mental disease. Let's figure out what is the cause of that disease. So they tend to get very upset, conspiracy theorists, at the scholarly work on conspiracy theories. And certainly you do have to look at the political context and realize that there are reasons for people to suspect their government of conspiracies. It's just that a lot of the energy tends to go in the wrong direction.
When Hofstadter wrote The Paranoid Style, conspiracy theorizing was considered to be a feature of the fringe right, the very far right. That seems to have moved across the political spectrum considerably over the last 50 or 60 years. What's responsible for that, do you think?
Well, I think when Hofstadter was writing, he was writing in 1964, Goldwater was nominated, and he was looking around him and seeing lots of, right-wingers who seemed pretty crazy, who seemed extreme, who had conspiracy theories about the fluoridation of the water and communists in the government. And so he quite naturally, a product of his time, wrote about right-wing conspiracy theories. I think after Vietnam and Watergate and the Church Committee and the revelations of real conspiracies in the U.S. government, a lot of people began to realize that it isn't just the fringe that has conspiracy theories. It's also the political center. It is the people who have power. J. Edgar Hoover had conspiracy theories. Richard Nixon had conspiracy theories. They're just the official conspiracy theories because they were the ones who controlled the government. But nevertheless, they believe that there were plots against them. So it's a mistake to see conspiracy theories as just the loony left or the loony right.
Yeah, that leads me to my final question. The term conspiracy theory is usually perceived as dismissive and offensive to people who believe in them. And certainly, as we've said several times through the course of this interview, there are real conspiracies in history. So how can we distinguish between, you know, that conspiracy theory said with a bit of a dismissive eye roll and the actual ones? Are there some kinds of markers or guidelines that can help us sort this out?
Well, evidence, I guess. You know, Iran-Contra was a conspiracy theory until the evidence came out that it was an actual conspiracy. There were conspiracy theories about the Nixon administration that turned out to be true. So we don't say the conspiracy theory of Watergate. We say the conspiracy of Watergate. And so what conspiracy theorists have to do is find the evidence for their claims. They're all historians, and they're looking back in the past, and they have an interpretation of events, and they need to marshal the evidence for their argument for that interpretation. And if they can't find the evidence that convinces enough people, then it just remains a conspiracy theory.
That was Kathy Olmsted, a professor of history at the University of California, Davis, and author of Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories in American Democracy, World War I to 9/11, published by Oxford University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'm taking a cue from the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, which is observing the 10th anniversary of 9/11 by playing Mahler's Second Symphony, The Resurrection. I'm not your most religious or even spiritual person, and tales of an afterlife don't melt my skepticism, but the emotional tone of this music seems just right for the occasion. It would have been grand had American society used the occasion of 9/11 to reflect on its imperial violence instead of using it as a pretext for yet another round of that violence. That might have been a secular resurrection of sorts, but at least we can imagine such an outcome while listening to Mahler. Here's some of the finale with Pierre Boulez conducting the Vienna Philharmonic. Till next week, bye.